KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
They're going to join, well, one of them, Jason Dodson, will join us in about half an hour, play some music in our studios, talk about their work, talk about what's happening in this burgeoning scene of music in the Northwest. It's very exciting. But first, state geologists say Whidbey Island is recovering from that landslide that moved enough earth to fill a football stadium 90 feet high. I think I saw that stadium just down at the end of the road here. Nobody was injured in Wednesday's landslide. But what happened? Why did it happen? Stephen Slaughter is a geologist with the Department of Natural Resources. Stephen Slaughter, thanks for talking to us.
Hey, Steve, thank you.
You were there on Wednesday. What did you see as a geologist? What did you see poking out of the bones of Whidbey Island?
Saw a really large landslide. We started off on the coastline and walked along the bottom of the landslide, and we saw a beach that was uplifted about 30 feet and pushed out about another maybe 300 feet at the most.
So the side of the hill went underneath the beach below it and lifted it up?
Exactly, yeah. The failure plane is somewhere, of this large landslide, is somewhere beneath the sea level, and it pushed up the beach and kind of pushed it out a little bit too. And those pictures you see in the news media right now, that's actually the beach, like gravels and sands that are now 30 feet above the sea level in this driftwood that's stranded. It's very impressive.
Are there other examples of a landslide like that along the shoreline that have lasted for some amount of time?
Well, Puget Sound area has many deep-seated landslides that are in various ages and dates. This landslide is a very small example of a much larger landslide that's about a mile and a half long. So this little landslide, if you can call it little, reactivated, and it's actually part of a much longer landslide. But we've had examples. Carolyn Beach was a recent example. I'm not sure when that one occurred. But this isn't a rare occurrence. It may seem like it in our sort of human perspective, but in the geologic time scale, it happens often.
You know, state geologists, yourself, estimate 5.1 million square feet of earth were moved by this slide at Ledgewood Beach, part of a much larger landslide complex that goes back 11,000 years. What does that mean?
It means that larger landslide, about a mile and a half long, has been there for at least 11,000 years, probably. We've never actually dated it, but we've had it identified since the late 70s. We remapped it in 2009. We know it's there. We've known it's there. And so it's just a smaller feature in something that's much larger on the landscape. And it just reactivated. It's a very small part of it. We had it reactivate. A small part of it reactivated in 1996 or 97, about 800 feet north of the current landslide, and a house is damaged in that one also.
So DNR did some geologic mapping in 2009, Stephen Slaughter, that looked at the extent of this landslide complex. You folks are familiar with what's happening. What makes a landslide complex? What makes this area more prone for landslides than those that aren't?
Well, the geology is a primary driver out here. We have this glacial geology where we had massive ice sheets that covered the Puget Sound area some maybe 11, 12, 13,000 years ago, depending on where you're at. And in this area, on Whidbey Island, we had probably about 4,000 feet of ice there. And we have this impermeable till cap that caps a lot of Whidbey Island. It's a very thick concrete-like made up of silt, sand, clay, and gravel that's very hard. And then beneath that, we have the sand layer that's very permeable and very soft. You can poke your finger in it. And this till cap protects the softer layer beneath it. And so we can actually have deep-seated landslides that form because we form these oversteepened slopes, as we're all familiar with throughout the Puget Sound area. People like to build their houses on the edge of these slopes to get these great views. They're building on this till cap, and they got these soft sands and those clays beneath that too that are that will fail in the form of a landslide. And sometimes it's very small, just little sloughs, and sometimes in the example of Wee Ballend here, it was a much larger event.
Sometimes we think of them failing when there's lots of land and the ground is saturated. Did that happen here?
That's hard to say. They don't traditionally get a lot of rain out there. We have reports that the king tides that we had back in, I think, February may have impacted that area a little more severely than other parts of the Puget Sound area. Maybe we had... We know we had the king tides, the water was much higher. That water could have been, with the addition of wave action, could have eroded at the base of the slope as the water is a little higher than usual and removed essentially what we call the toe of the landslide. And the toe acts as it's the lowest part of the landslide, and it kind of works as a natural retaining wall. And this tidal action could have eaten away at this toe a little bit, and the landslide was actually lost its retaining wall and sort of remobilized to sort of fill in the place of that retaining wall that was destroyed.
Stephen,
that's our speculation at this point. We need to do a lot more investigation. We're getting out there. We're trying to fly some air photos here pretty soon and maybe get some more topographic data. We want to research this thing quite a bit to see what's going on.
So this is part of a natural occurrence, Stephen Slaughter. This is part of the way our landscape works in the Northwest. Given that, is there a way to, and should we, if there is, try to prevent these, make the areas safer for housing and people? I know that's a comp. First, I'll ask it in two parts, but you know where I'm leading. Is there a way to make this a more safe area from landslides? Prevent landslides?
I think the best way to do it is to take people out of harm's way. I don't think we can prevent these features, these things from happening. This is a big event. There's smaller ones that occur. People building their houses on the very edge of a slope is not a good idea. Many of these houses were built quite a ways off the slope. Houses on the top of the slope, I should say, on top of the landslides carp. They're a long ways away, and there's a reason for that. People that live there know there's a landslide, and they know that it's been actively, parts of it have been rilling and failing in small portions. That's probably the best way to manage it is by helping people make better decisions about where they live.
They were a long way away, as you say. When you look at the pictures, some of them are not anymore.
Yes.
The top of this landslide scarp, 200 feet above sea level. The landslide, as you said, uplifted the beach 30 feet high. The toe of the landslide is slightly over 1,000 feet long, 300 feet into Puget Sound. What would DNR do? What could happen with that toe that extends out into Puget Sound? Does that eventually be washed away by the tides, or does the man come in and bulldoze it away? What occurs?
Oh, I think the tides will do a good job of taking care of it because, this is a much larger, older landslide, and this probably has happened before, and you have essentially a straight beach. Well, not anymore. You have that little toe sticking out, but it was a straight beach, and it'll probably be eroded away by tidal action, wave action. I don't think we have any reason to go down there and do anything about it as far as bulldozing it away. I think that nature will take its course with this feature. And again, this is that toe, which is that natural retaining wall that's going to be eaten away, and that landslide may move a little bit and continue to move, not as dramatic as we saw on Wednesday, but we'll probably see small portions of it move here and there for probably weeks to months to come as this thing's slowly eaten away. And it may take years for it to actually be removed, so to speak, from the landscape.
The landslide sounds very dynamic, almost alive in the way you describe it, just the feature itself.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Definitely. When we were out there, you could hear trees creaking, and it wasn't a lot of movement in the land, but there was definitely things going on, between the helicopters and all other noise going around. It was difficult to hear all these things, but, there's the slopes were The high bluff was dropping just small amounts of dirt here and there, and it was a, you could almost call it like some sort of organism.
Very interesting. Stephen Slaughter, thank you for taking the time to talk to us.
You're welcome, Steve.
Stephen Slaughter is a geologist with the Department of Natural Resources. Geologists estimate that Wednesday's landslide on Whidbey Island moved enough earth to fill a football stadium 93 feet high. That was in the Seattle Times. 5.3 million square feet of earth were moved by the slide at Ledgewood Beach. Might date back to a landslide complex that's 11,000 years old, but nobody was hurt. This is Weekday.
The planet keeps doing its thing, no matter the desires of man.
Yep.
It's 9:15. How to focus and concentrate in the whirlwind of this information age in a minute.
Support for KUOW comes from Group Health Cooperative. 65 years ago, Group Health integrated healthcare and healthcare coverage with one goal, better health for everyone. Information at ghc.org/one goal.
. 50 degrees in Seattle, partly cloudy. Forecast says it's going to be mostly sunny this afternoon with a predicted high of 60. Jason Dodson, lead singer and guitarist of the popular Seattle band The Maldives, is going to be here to talk music and play music in about 15 minutes. KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
So we're going to go from landslides to concentration to the Maldives in the next half hour. We are an example of this digital age here on the program. We do lots of things, and then we say, I'm having trouble remembering what I was doing. Dr. David Levy is a professor in the Information School at the University of Washington. He's a technologist by training. He has diplomas in calligraphy and bookbinding. He teaches a class in helping students find a way to focus and concentrate. Good to see you again.
Good to see you.
May I say that you are a technologist, a calligrapher, a bookbinder. Are you an example of you know, so much information that you just keep moving around?
Well, actually, I would say that what I've been working on for the last couple of decades is how to live a more balanced life. So my meditation practice, at one time my calligraphy work and all of that, was an attempt to figure out how I could be online and be a technologist and also not be crazy. So I don't think I figured it all out, but I'm working on it.
You told me when we were talking a little bit ago that there's this very long article that I read in Chronicle.com. It's the Chronicle of Higher Education, right? About this notion. You're distracted. People are distracted. And you've come up with a class to help students. Very long article. And what were some of the comments in the article?
Well, it's interesting to read some of the comments from readers all over the country who said, wow, the article was too long. How did it end?
One of the things you, in thinking about this, and you said you were concerned about thinking about, was how are people going to sit down and read some of the long books of, you know, of Dostoevsky, of Tolstoy, Stendhal, and concentrate on a long novel with intricate, complex characters in an age when we really kind of absorb things in, you know, pictures and paragraphs, and we like to move on.
Well, first, Steve, it wasn't me who said that in the article. It was actually a historian who was being quoted
who
worried about that.
See, you know what that tells you?
Because I actually read the article.
What does that tell you?
I
skimmed it.
Yeah, you skimmed it. But I will tell you that it's a much more complex picture than those simplistic worries. So, for example, I've had a student this year who is probably in his early 20s who told me he was reading Moby Dick to his girlfriend all quarter. So I really worry about our trying to divide up the world and think that it's all going to hell in a handbasket. Nobody can concentrate anymore, and the problem is the technologies. My perspective on all of this is that through education and training, like the class that I've been teaching, we can learn to concentrate better and to focus for longer periods of time if we choose to do so.
All right, I want to get to that. But is this a problem of the age, or have we always had to learn to concentrate?
We've always had to learn to concentrate, I think, and each era is somewhat different. In the era that I grew up in, you know, in the 50s and 60s, basically you learn concentration as a byproduct of schooling. You know, sit in your chair, fold your hands, Learning to read is in some sense a concentration practice.
We were sort of taught that those efforts were to make us cogs in the working machinery. I don't know that we thought, oh, this is helping us focus so that we can read War and Peace.
Well, I think you've put your finger on something really important. Part of the reason for that kind of focusing was to make people in the late 19th century better factory workers who could stay on task. But it turns out, and the science is really showing this, that our ability to attend and to focus better leads to a higher quality of life and to many good things as well.
So how does the science show that? What's the research that's been done?
Well, there is increasing amount of research, first of all, that shows that you can train people to be better concentrated and that along with greater concentration comes better ability to manage emotions, emotional regulation. And if you're better able to deal with, for example, difficult emotions, then you can ride the ups and downs of life better and feel more comfortable.
Are these related ideas that we learn to concentrate so that we can read Moby Dick? We are also learning to regulate the ups and downs of our emotions?
That's a really great question. I don't know about the specifics of an experiment that would get people to read Moby Dick and see whether or not their emotions are better. But I think that in broad outline, that would be the kind of argument that neuroscience and cognitive psychology is beginning to make.
So in looking at this, in looking at the historical research, in talking to your students,
right,
is this age any more damaging to our ability to concentrate because of the technologies that we play with?
You know, Steve, I've been asked that many, many times, and I tend to dodge that question because I think it's really tricky historically. I'm much more comfortable not trying to sort of make a blanket statement about whether our age, whether we are more distracted now or not, which I will leave to social scientists. I'm a computer scientist by training to figure out, but rather what can we do about it and where are we trying to get to in our culture? Sorry.
That's good. That's fine. The Atlantic magazine had a cover story on whether giving kids iPads was helping them learn or making them more distracted. The conclusion of the article was, quit worrying about it. They're just going to put the iPad away in a few days and go back to playing with their G.I. Joes and Barbies. What do you suggest to your students by way of teaching us at our later age, in our teens and 20s, to learn to concentrate?
Well, what we start off by looking at in the course is the fact that there are some very simple, basic aspects of the way the human attentional system works that we can train. One is, of course, the ability to stay focused on one thing. A second ability is the ability to notice other things that are going on around you. And the third is making a decision about what to pay attention to in the moment. So, and the first of those is called focused attention. The second one is called open monitoring or open awareness. And just to put it in really simple terms for our listeners, if you think about the skills that are involved in, say, trying to cross a street, a busy street with traffic, one, you need to be able to focus on getting across to the other side. So that's focused attention. But you also need to have enough open attention or awareness to notice if something happens, like somebody runs a red light, right? And then if you hear a disturbance like a car horn or something like that, you need to be able to figure out in the moment whether to stay with your original task, which was to cross the street, or whether to get out of the way of a car.
All right. You were going to give us examples, but let me stick with that for a moment.
Sure.
Because it's always seemed to me that driving is an amazing skill that we have because of that we're doing all those things. Is that the same skill that you're saying, that body of skills, that basket of skills that we can bring to school?
Yes, and let me give you an example. So let's take the equivalent of crossing the street, but now we're online. So say you're sitting there with your laptop, you're reading an email message, right? So that's your object of concentration. You're focusing on reading an email message. And then suddenly you get an instant message or your phone rings or you realize that a text has come in. There is the equivalent of the car horn honking. It's potentially a distractor or it's something that you might want to pay attention to. So the skill then becomes of attention. Can you notice that other event or trigger that has just happened and make a wise decision for yourself in the moment about whether to go back to reading the email message or whether to go answer that text message that just came in. Those are the full set of skills, and they're the same whether we're online or whether we're crossing a street.
So people have complained about that. You just put your finger on what people say they get distracted by when they sit at their desk and they have a big screen and these things pop up. So is this just about recognizing it's just like driving and we have to learn and then apply the same set of skills? I mean, just physically, like we took driving school, we need to take attention to computer skills?
Well, it's that and a bit more. One is that it turns out that we can train our attention muscle to be more attentive, to be stronger and more flexible. Like if you go study yoga because you want a stronger and more flexible body, right? You can do the same thing with the mind. And part of what that means is as your attention gets stronger, you can notice potential distractors and not necessarily have to go to those distractors.
As your attention gets stronger. How do you strengthen attention?
The most basic practice that we use in the class, which is a universal practice, is a practice of paying attention to your breathing, feeling the in-breath and the out-breath. And then, of course, what happens is even though you're trying to stay focused on your breathing, suddenly your mind distracts you with something else. Oh, I forgot to put milk on the to-do list, on the grocery list or something like that. Then the question becomes, can you notice that internal distraction and then come back and pay attention to the breath again? And the way I like to talk about it is that every time you come back to your primary object of focus, namely the breath, that it's like doing reps in the gym. You're strengthening your attention muscle.
When you're driving, is that equivalent to where's the paying attention to your breath when you're driving or when, you know, let's stick with driving.
It's paying attention to the road.
When we are driving, sometimes we go, especially when you're on a highway and things get kind of same, you can go 20 miles and you go, oh, where did that 20 miles go?
Exactly.
Am I meditating or am I spacing out? Am I paying attention because I seem to be, or have I lost my focus?
Well, I mean, I can't answer for everybody, but typically what's happening is you're spacing out and you're taking driving as you're using the more automatized parts of your brain to do that. But what we're really trying to train people to do is to maintain focused, grounded, and full awareness in the moment, which is different than that kind of zoning out.
David Levy holds a PhD from Stanford in computer science that he got, what is that, 30 years ago? Now, calligraphy, bookbinding at Roehampton Institute. He was at the Park Research Center, the Xerox Palo Alto Research Center, where his research focused on the nature of documents, on tools, on practices. Did that evolve into what you're did all that stuff lead you to thinking about what you're thinking about today?
No, exactly, it did. I mean, when I finished up my PhD at Stanford, I felt like there were other aspects of myself that were kind of calling to me. I felt a need to get to slow down and quiet down, and that took me to study calligraphy and bookbinding. To do a kind of practice that was more meditative, even though I wouldn't have called it meditative at the time. And then I went on to, I returned to the famed Xerox Palo Alto Research Center to look at the transition from the older technologies to the newer ones. And then about 20 years ago, I started noticing that people were beginning to feel more overloaded and distracted, that life seemed to be accelerating. And so I put together my own contemplative practice, which was about training the mind and slowing down, with what I saw happening in the larger culture. And I started asking the question, is there a way that we as a culture and as individuals could achieve better balance so we could use the technologies to their best advantage and to ours, that we could use them in powerful ways but also remain focused and calm?
So in the last 2 minutes that we have left,
please
give me or all of us a way when we sit down in front of the computer or we sit down in front of the television or any of the myriad of ways which we are distracted today to begin to exercise the attention muscle.
Well, the simplest thing to do, which is something you can practice any time during the day, and listeners can do it right at this very moment, is you can sit comfortably, try to relax your body, your shoulders, and simply take a couple of conscious breaths. right at this very moment, feel your breath coming in to your lungs and your belly and expelled. And along with that attempt to be more present to your breath at the moment, to recall your intention, if this is what your intention is, to be more present in the very next thing that you're going to do, which is answer email or surf the web or talk to a friend.
You know, we put this very long article from the Chronicle of Higher Education up on our website, and if you want to read it and read the comments, you can look at it there as well. I liked your email drill, which is what we talked about. There's some interesting things. All right. I'm going to do – I will now pay attention to my next thing in the moment.
So will I.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
It was good to talk to you again. I hope we do it again. David Levy holds a PhD from Stanford. He has been thinking about concentration and how we can do it. He's a professor in the Information School at the University of Washington. This is Weekday.
Music of the Maldives there. In a moment here, we're going to be joined by Maldives frontman Jason Dodson. Hang on, that's just ahead. You rely on KOW to bring you news and information that reflect our world, and we rely on you. Listener support makes everything you hear on KOW possible. Right now, your support will help keep our upcoming spring membership drive on target so we can get you back to regular programming sooner. So make your gift online today at KUOW.org and help give the drive a head start. Thanks. Because 52 degrees in Seattle, working towards a high today of 60. Forecast says it's going to be sunny by this afternoon. Then overnight, a clear, starry sky, a low of 45. Tomorrow, Saturday, sunny with a high of 64. And Sunday, sunny with a high possibly hitting 70.
Support for KUOW comes from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation. Knight Foundation promotes informed and engaged communities and helps NPR advance quality journalism in the digital age. More at knightfoundation.org.
I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 9:32. Those big container ships we see out in Puget Sound, what's it like on board those ships? More specifically, what does it sound like on the deck of one of those bad boys? The containers are creaking, the ocean is roiling, there's a lot going on. We're going to listen to that in 20 minutes. But first, we're going to listen to a different kind of sound, music. We've got the front man from the Maldives here, Jason Dodson, and we're going to talk to him momentarily.
Come on, come on, from Muscle to the Wing. The Maldives' most recent release. I should actually say newest, right? That's fair enough. Jason Dodson is a vocalist, guitar player for the Seattle band, the Maldives, in our studios. It's good to see you and to meet you.
Yes, nice to meet you as well.
We were talking about concentration and shifting focus, but staying focused.
I'm pretty good at staying focused.
Are you?
Yeah, pretty good, especially early in the morning, like right now.
When do you write?
I usually don't reveal that process.
All right.
Yeah, I'm kind of secretive about what I do.
But being focused is the key.
Yeah, I do my best focus when I'm just walking around. So a lot of walking and aimless wandering.
That's the way it should be.
Thanks.
How long have you been writing?
Probably for about 18 years.
When did you decide that it was music and songs that you were writing and not, you know, poetry, nonfiction?
It was, I went to UW and I was a cinema studies major, so I studied film. And so that kind of, my plan was to be a screenwriter, and then that didn't seem like the most, I just kind of lost interest in it, if that makes any sense. And then my friend just asked me, because I always wore band shirts, because I always liked music, and so he asked me if I played music, and I said, well, I'd play in my room or whatever, and so I ended up just writing songs, and then...
So you were... 13, 14, you weren't in your room writing songs?
No, not that young. I was pretty much 13, 14, I was pretty obsessed with, like Bob Dylan and Neil Young, but I was more interested in Raymond Carver. Yeah, I was writing short stories and I thought I could be Hemingway, but it didn't work out that way.
Who knows but that your songs aren't Raymond Carver-esque, right?
They might be. I don't know. I'm probably not that as smart or as edited as he was.
Did you grow up here?
I was born in Virginia. I grew up a lot just throughout, I grew up all around the United States. So it was California, South Carolina, North Carolina, Alaska, Oregon. I spent most of the formative years in Vancouver, Washington.
Why were you moving around so much?
My dad was just a salesman. And by the time we landed in Vancouver, my parents got divorced. And so we stayed.
You know, I read in the various writings up about you folks, and I'm sure you guys wrote it as well, as much a family and group of friends as a band.
That's true.
Why is that? How'd that occur?
It just happened gradually over the years. I think people always make comments, say, you're such a large band. There's so many members. But it's kind of just an extended family. We always have lots of members because we always like the people we're playing with. And after a while, it became easier to tour that way because one of us would get mad at the other one. And so we always had somebody else to turn to and talk with about that person. It is like a family. I mean, I think most bands hopefully are like families that you can, you know, you can do something that you love and share that with these people that you really love and care about.
You guys have been a live band. You guys have been about being on the stage and playing music for people,
yeah,
as opposed to being in the studios,
yeah,
exclusively. Because is that a family feeling as well? Being together, being in a group, sharing.
Yeah, that's part of what I think we've been able to succeed at is just working our songs out on stage, as opposed to a lot of bands will just spend time in the studio and work on the songs there. For some reason, we just were able to click better on stage. So the pressure of having to be in front of other people playing something that maybe we're not 100% confident with, but once we get up there, we have to do it, and then we just have a lot of fun. So we just, you know, we can look at each other and just know that we're going to do it.
You made a joke, Jason Dodson, when you came in with your guitar,
yeah,
that you were going to serenade me because it's,
yeah,
just cute. But look, there's actually a lot of people around here.
There is.
And there are a lot of people listening as well. Do you show up? You said you work your songs out.
Yeah.
So do you show up with a version of the song and then people start picking and plunking at it and working it away?
Pretty much. I have a hard time, and usually, I have a hard time playing, writing with other people. And it's not because I'm pretty magnanimous. I'm not a jerk or anything. It's just when I sit down to write a song, it's usually something that I know I can play. And I'm not a good musician. So what's probably the easiest way to put it is that I can work out something with chords that I understand. But if I try to follow somebody else, or if there's been situations where people say, oh, yeah, sit in and play with me on this, and I don't know my way around a guitar that well. And I just find it so much easier just to write something, bring it to the table, and have the rest of the band just make it sound awesome, because most of the time I have no idea what even chord I'm playing. So, and that's true.
There you go. But let's listen. Do you have a song for us?
I do. I have to preface it. It has one bad word in it, but I can either... I should have asked before.
Hum it.
Hum it? Okay, I'll hum it. so this is a song. It's called All Those Winter Days, and it's something usually I play solo or with Sons of War Notes, which is my weird little side project. But okay, so let's go.
All those winter days, chasing the sun. Your endless winter ways, you never stay too long.
Jason Dodson. All those winter days in our studios, vocalist, guitarist, the Seattle band, the Maldives. When you were writing all those Raymond Carver short stories, were you humming to yourself? When did you know you could sing?
Well, my dad always said I could sing, and I never trusted him. But well, that sounds awful. I do trust him, but at the time, I just remember I was a kid, you know, I was like, my dad said, you can sing, son. I'm like, oh, no, I can't. No, I can't do that. And maybe it's just simple, like, you know, childhood rebellion or whatever. But I don't know. Like, I'm still working on it. You know, I don't think the voice is ever fully realized. You know, I think it's always a work in progress.
Do you feel that way about your writing, too?
Absolutely. Yeah, I hope I never reach perfection. it would be a sad day. But
you don't have to have a day job, do you?
I do. Yeah, I do have a day job.
What's your day job?
I work at Scarecrow Video, just up the street there. I've worked there for a long time. They've been so supportive of just me being able to take time off to tour and take time off to play shows. So it's always been good. And also they gave me health insurance. So that's something that's really rare for musicians, because musicians don't really – I think we're seen as an insurance risk.
Yeah. And then you can still look at your Renoir or whoever else you like to watch.
I do like Renoir, but I think I'm more of a – I like John Ford. I like Westerns. And John Ford, and I've been obsessed a little bit with what is it? Paul Thomas Anderson lately. I saw that movie, The Master, and it's one of the weirdest movies I've ever seen, and it just took me to a place. I keep obsessing about it.
Boy, a far cry from John Ford. Do you see similarities between The Master and The Searchers?
Yeah, there's probably some. They both use a lot of similar shots, like the way that the composition of the frame. They use a lot of frames within frames.
Yeah.
But other than that, you know, thematically, they're not really similar.
Hey, what do you think? Do you write frames within frames? Do you tell stories within stories in your songs?
Probably. I've never. The more I think about a song, the less exciting it gets for me. If that makes sense. I always think of that quote from Deadwood, the TV show. It's like, I'm stupidest when I try to be funny. And I feel the same way about my songwriting. I think I write poorly when I'm trying to write. So I usually just try to not think about it and just do it.
There we are back again to meditation and focus.
Focus, meditation.
Where we started.
Yep.
That's great. Where are you guys performing next?
I'm actually performing tonight. It's a benefit show at the Sunset for Camp Thunderbird. It's in South Dakota, and it's just a camp for underprivileged Native American kids. And so they asked me to headline it, which I think is really strange, because it's just going to be me and a guitar. But hopefully I can entertain some people. I know a few jokes, but they're not appropriate for a daytime talk radio.
Well, you know, and you probably won't have the kids at the
I don't think so.
At the bar either, so you'd be all right.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah, I'm excited. Other than that, I'm trying to think. The next Maldives show.
I'll tell you.
Okay, you can tell me.
I'll tell you. Will you play us another song?
Yeah.
Do you have
okay,
one?
Okay, I do. I have lots of songs, but I was going to... This was the longest song I have, though. I have a tendency, even though it's like there's an economy of words, there's not an economy of time. It's called Go Back to Virginia.
And do you want me to tell you how much longer we have?
Yeah.
4 minutes.
4 minutes? I can't play that song then.
We could just tell jokes.
Let's see here. I'll do Muscle for the Wing. That's the title track. It's been a while since I played it, so bear with me.
There's a hole in my head, so all the light can shine. I can speak to the dead and they are always crying out for more. Crying out for more. Do you really believe that you are ordinary? Every time that you breathe, you are extraordinary. Do you know what I mean? Muscle for the wind, forest for the birds to sing. Do you know what I mean? I'm in over my head, but I can't talk about it. I just keep lying in bed, I can't stop thinking about it all. Oh, oh, oh. While we're getting ahead, we are really dying. Does that fill you with dread? Will you just keep on trying? Try to believe. Try to believe. Do you know what I mean? Muscle for the wind, forest for the birds to sing. Do you know what I mean? I want you to
pretty good for not having played that song in a while.
It's been a while since I played it solo. Usually there's a, you know, a bunch of freaks making noise on top of it.
Muscle for the Wing is the title track to the Maldives' newest release. Jason Dodson is singer and songwriter with the Maldives. Seattle musicians play songs of summer to benefit Camp Thunderbird. That's tonight at the Sunset. Jason Dodson of the Maldives, Kevin Murphy of the Moondoggies, Kimberly Morrison, the Duchess and the Dukes. A lot of folks going to be there. 11:47 with fees for the tickets.
Really?
It's a pretty good deal.
Yeah, it's a great deal.
Starts at 9 p.m. tonight at the Sunset. Next show, the Maldives, April 6th, Port Townsend.
Oh, that's right. It's Port Townsend at Sirens. It's a place called Sirens.
And then you drive down to Portland the next night, April 6th.
Yeah, and I have a week-long residency at Al's Den in Portland. So it's just going to be me playing with a bunch of good friends from Seattle. I'm actually bringing down my friend Aaron Dugas from the band, the Ganges River Band, and Star Anna from Star Anna, and Kevin Murphy from the Moondoggies. He'll be coming down for a couple nights, too, and my friend Fred Luongo. He's in a band called the Swearingens, which kind of brings it back full circle to the Deadwood reference earlier. So
there you go.
Yeah, it'll be a fun week.
I really appreciate you coming in this morning and playing
Thanks,
and talking
Steve.
To us. And I hope you can come back when we'll leave time for the longer songs, because we can concentrate.
Yeah, I hope so. Thank you so much, Steve.
Thank you, sir. This is Weekday. And now.
And now.
This is the sound of the week. The sound of the week.
What you're hearing are shipping containers stacked aboard the Matson container ship MV Mokahana, grinding against each other with the ocean surging below. The recording was made when the ship was sailing from Long Beach, California to Honolulu, Hawaii. After Hawaii, the ship continued to Oakland and then back to Long Beach. Listener David sent that sound to us. He sails with the Sailors Union of the Pacific, and they provide unlicensed deck labor for Matson ships. I love that sound, the sound of commerce. If you have a sound to share with us, please do. Send 30 seconds of it to weekday at kuow.org. Put sound of the day in the subject line. And if anybody wants to give us a tour of the harbor and the port, I would be happy to take that tour and just record all those interesting sounds. You never know. Nick Bond, you sent us an email that said, let's think about frost. And of course, that was because we didn't really have to think too much about frost anymore, right?
Well, not around the Seattle area too much. In most years, we have our last 32-degree temperatures in mid-March or so. And I might add, we have our kind of first 70-degree temperatures in mid-April or so. And maybe I'm getting a little ahead of myself.
No, I heard we were going to get a little 70 degrees maybe this weekend.
Well, we have the prospect of that on Sunday. Today will be something like 60, probably mid-60s on Saturday, mid to upper 60s. Maybe a few places actually hit 70 on Sunday. I doubt in Seattle itself it'll get there, but there shouldn't be any complaints. Those that happen to be distressed at that prospect are advised, though, to book a ticket to Fargo, North Dakota. Easter day there should be in the mid-20s with stiff north winds.
Oh, good.
But, again, back to our neck of the woods. We usually have to wait till mid-April to have a 70-degree day. And so if we do get one, that means we're a little bit of ahead of schedule, certainly. And just 2 years ago, we had to wait until the 20th of May to get our first 70-degree day.
Yeah, I think I remember that. So maybe we won't have that kind of spring this year. Maybe we'll have a little more spring-like spring.
Yeah, that's right. And getting back to the, you know, the last frost sort of business, there what's kind of interesting around here is how much it varies from spot to spot. It Some of the warmer spots, your last 32 Fahrenheit temperatures can be in typically in early March. In some of the cold spots like Olympia, it's May before you get rid of those frosts. And right here at SeaTac Airport, the latest we've had our last frost is the 1st of May, and the earliest up until this year is the 3rd of February. This year is quite unusual because the last freezing temperatures we've had at the airport was on the 22nd of January.
Wow, really?
And so if that holds, and there's every sign that it will, that'll be by far the earliest last frost on the record. So, you know, we've still had kind of light frost where you've gotten to scrape your windshield in the morning and there's, you know, a little bit of ice on the lawns and so forth. But actually getting down to 32 at SeaTac, it's been a while.
Is there a definition, a weather definition of frost and how it forms?
Well, we know how it forms. The definition there is kind of loose. Sometimes there are frosts and there are killing frosts. And I've seen a definition where a killing frost is one in which it's 32 degrees or less for enough hours, enough time, so that it can damage tender plants. But I think we're kind of vague with our language there. The frosts themselves occur when a surface gets down to the freezing point, there's enough moisture in the air. And that can actually occur when the temperatures are a little above freezing.
Yeah.
And you know, that's kind of a 101 lesson that I'm not sure you want to endure right now. But
all right, well, I like the way you say that. All right, we'll endure it another time.
Yeah, that's right.
All right, sir, I appreciate again you talking to us.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Nick Bond is the Washington State climatologist. He also works at the Joint Institute for the Study of Atmosphere and Ocean. Joins us with weather and 101, 102, 103 lessons as well. Stay with us. We're going to review the news of this week on weekday on 94.9 KUOW Seattle.
Shall we go out with a little more music of the Maldives?
I think we should.
Let's do it. That's the Maldives. It's 10 o'clock. KUOW FM Seattle. KUOW Tumwater. KQOW. Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.